This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello to one of my favorite people, authors, Anna Lazowski. How are things in Winnipeg, Canada?
Very hot and muggy. How about you?
Here in Tel Aviv, hot and muggy. We could be next door.
We could. That would be nice, actually.
You're back on the show, and I'm so delighted. There's something about you, your spirit, your personality, and the wonderful books that you write, and maybe the fact that we're both from Winnipeg.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. So we know how to suffer.
Yes.
So welcome. So we're celebrating a new children's book of yours, which just launched about a month or two ago.
Ooh.
And it's called Dark to Cloud from Kids Can Press. And why don't you wave it all over the screen so the people watching the video can see it, illustrated by Penny Neville Lee from Britain.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, she lives in Manchester, I think.
Yes. And this is a wonderful, well, Manchester's in Britain. And this is a wonderful opportunity to talk a little bit about your book.
Mm-hmm.
And to show people some pages, except for the podcasters.
Yeah, they'll have to imagine a lot of charcoal grays, dark muted colors.
I love it.
It's about a little girl named Abigail, so that people can see her, who suddenly has a dark cloud that appears in her life, and she goes about, you know, not really enjoying things she used to like her birthday party. She's a little bit in shadows there, and then slowly over time she starts to understand what's going on. She gets some support from her dad. I'm just going to find that page. Oh, actually, you know what, I'm going to show you one of my very favorite pages that Penny drew, which is this. I need to find it. She drew this beautiful double page spread. I'm going to have to show it to you in parts. So there's Abigail at the library, but it's this whole other page of the library too. And you can see these pipes underground, and there's all these little details, like little posters and birds. And it's just like, I think it's incredible. I kind of couldn't believe it when I saw that page. But over time, she kind of gets comfortable and understands what her life is like and is able to find, you know, moments of joy, despite the fact that she's dealing with what is not ever specifically referenced in the text of the book, but is depression with like little elements of anxiety in it as well. And then at the end, you know, the end papers are lovely because they go from this black and white floral pattern into full color at the end. That's just really lovely. Yeah.
The transition is spectacular. I'm not, as you know, I'm not a maven on illustrations. I mean, we're both lucky to have great illustrators, but there's something, it's not exactly gray.
No.
Like at the beginning, it's not gray. There's hints of blue and hints of purple. Mm-hmm. Can you show a page like that? I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, the first page in her living room, it's almost got like a bit of a greenish kind of, I don't know if you can see this, but it's got like a bit of a greenish kind of hue to it. Mm-hmm. And then there's, yeah, a little, and her legs are kind of purple.
Yeah, and then like there's shades of, it's gray with shades of, of green and blue. Like the colors are there. They're somehow prevented from coming out. So this is, you know, T-Rex is a crazy Michigana, hilarious take on the things that animals cannot do, an alphabet book. If I remember properly, it's in rhyme. Am I remembering rightly?
It's not. No,
then
it's not
in rhyme. I can remember wrongly, you know.
Yeah, well, you read a lot of books. That was a year, 2 years ago. That's fine.
Yeah. I just remembered how much fun it was. And this book is allegorical and less fun.
Yes. Yeah.
That was a question.
Why is that? What happened there? it's funny because, you know, as you get deeper into this, be like, you know, build your brand, make sure, like, do one thing and really, like, go all in. It was the same for me when I was in art school, because I took my BFA in fine arts. So it was the same thing. It was like, you don't want to try too many things. You want to, like, pick a lane and stay in that lane. That's your lane. And I was just like, I don't really want to do that. Like, I want to try a lot of things. I want to do a bunch of different things. So I think I kind of felt the same way, not at the beginning of picture book writing, like when you don't know a lot of other writers and you don't know all the rules and you're just like, I'm going to write what I want to write. So I kind of still kept doing that, even though maybe it's not the smartest thing. I don't know. But so yeah, my first book is super zany and wacky and has amazing, crazy illustrations by Steph LeBaris, but it's a book about hope, right? Like that's what the central, and that's what this book is. Like this is, sorry, this is a book about hope too. So I think the central premise of both books is the same. I just think the treatment and the way you get to it is different. But I love writing. Dark Cloud is much more like a lyrical style. It's not poetry, but it's little fragments and like images. And I really like writing that way. So my third book is actually very much like Dark Cloud that's coming out in like 2 more years. But
another opportunity for an interview.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's okay that they're different. Like for me, it's okay that they're different because it's like when you're reading, you don't want to just read one thing, right?
Of course it's fine that they're different.
Yeah, I know. But there is this feeling in the children's book world, like, you know, you really got to specialize at least for a while until you're famous enough and then you can branch out. And I'm just like, and you know, that's fine for people if they want to do that. But my brain doesn't.
Anna, my question is a different question.
What is your question?
What got into you to take a different tack to this hope approach?
Oh, like what inspired this actual book?
For example.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, with writers, you write so many kinds of books and you know, people only see some of them, right? So I'd written a bunch in this kind of lyrical sort of style. So they were in the back catalog that no one's ever seen. But this was a book that was inspired by something that happened with my daughter a few years ago. So she's 14 now. This was several years ago. She was prescribed an allergy medication at a time when we were transitioning a bunch of things. Like she changed school, she entered an immersion program. There was a lot of like new things happening. So we thought she was, over time, we thought, oh, she's kind of, you know, just getting used to this, a little bit stressed, that's okay. And then we realized that it was something else. Like her personality was slowly changing. She was pulling away. She was a really happy kid. She was always smiling and she just didn't smile anymore. And she just withdrew. And it's a lot of what you see happening with Abigail in the book. Like it's visual representation of what we saw with her. So once we figured out what was going on and took her off the medication, then we just kind of had to wait and hope that she would come out of it. You know, the doctor's like, oh, it'll be fine, it'll go away. But it took about a year for it to go away completely. And we had a lot of help. But it was a really hard thing to watch. And I think part of me processing that was writing about it in the book. And then Penny turned it into this completely gorgeous story. So, you know, as horrible as it was, but something lovely came out of it.
But the end of it, though, it reminds me a little bit of that movie with Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets, because it's not as if the cloud disappears entirely. It's just that you put it somewhere and you enter your color. Yes, and you enter your color world. I for many years suffered from agoraphobia. And you know, as you know, I have my life back and I fly and lecture and leave my house, but there's always a dark cloud somewhere. I mean, little kids don't get agoraphobia, so I would have to write a grown-up book, and I don't want to do that. So you're a very brave person. This is a wonderful book published in Canada, right? Kid Can Press.
Yeah, that was just kind of a lucky thing because I had written this book and it was just kind of sitting there. And then my agent at the time had put me in contact with Kathleen Keenan at Kids Can Press about a book that I liked, but she had something similar already. So I was like, okay, well, what else have you got? And she said, I'm looking for books about big emotions. And I was like, I have that book. So it went to her as an exclusive. And then they acquired it. And it was funny timing because I wrote it just before the pandemic, like in the January, before everything shut down in March. So I wrote it kind of went to her, everything shut down, everybody moved to work at home, meetings got pushed back, you know, and everything is just completely different. And then it took till about, I don't know, maybe May or June for everything to kind of come back online and find out that they were going to take the book. But it's funny, like now thinking about the timing of it, like there's so many more kids now dealing with things like this as we come out of everything that we've all collectively gone through over the last few years. Like I hear from so many people, and it's not necessarily depression, it's other things, right? Other mental health things that kids didn't have before. But when your whole world suddenly changes, it's a lot to try to process. And I think the grownups, we haven't really processed it that well either. Like we can't expect kids to, right? So I think there's probably going to be a greater need for books like this, talking like with even agoraphobia, anxiety, like everything. It's also kind of intermingled. It can be hard to separate what is what. So I think people being able to find their experiences in books like this can be really helpful.
Anna, you're very brave. There's another very brave thing in this. I almost counted the words. You know the word count. It's under 300 words.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very sparse.
It's sparsely written. It's lyrical. And usually, at least, I always thought that the more words you wrote until I started going to conferences, the more people would pay attention to you as the writer. But actually, there's kind of a opposite effect. But you need really a lot of ego power to write a story in less than 300 words.
Do you?
Maybe you don't.
I don't think about it.
Other people do. You know, you say a picture book should have less than 500 words. It gives it only 500 words. But actually, you can say a lot in 500 words.
You can. I mean, you often have to start out and you got to pick the best parts.
But you're way under the upper limit. You've left a ton of space for the illustrator. And that's very brave. And I want to get back to that afterwards. You know what? Let's get back to it now.
Okay. I'm ready.
Traditionally published authors usually don't pick the illustrator. They don't see the illustrations. Was that the case in your book?
No, sort of not that. So one of the nice things about, well, not nice things. One of the things that happened during the pandemic is we were all at home and we had a lot of free time, right? So while this book was out in the world waiting for me to find out if it was going to be acquired by Kids Can Press, you know, I had a lot of time, everything was slow. So I was spending a lot of time on Twitter looking at things, just killing time. And I saw this illustration that Penny posted of this beautiful, it basically is this, a bunch of it actually was reworked into the book, but it was a version of like this little girl with a cloud. And then it was a series of three. So there was this little girl with a cloud hugging a cloud and then sitting under this beautiful, all these beautiful, colorful flowers in the rain, which ended up turning up in the book too. I'm just going to show you that page. Like it's basically a version of these two pages. Mm-hmm. And she had posted, she had kind of a crummy day and she was, I think, on the bus or something. And she did these incredible illustrations and posted it. And I was like, oh my gosh, that looks like Abigail. Like that looks like the little girl in the book that I'm waiting to find out if someone's going to publish it. So I copied the link to her tweet and stuck it in my Google Doc and said, if they acquire it, you know, I'm going to just put her name in front of their faces as well, because she hadn't done any picture books. She'd done other things. And a lot of people know who Penny is. She's got incredible work and she's very active on Twitter. She's on Instagram, but she hadn't done picture books yet. So I was like, this would be amazing. So luckily, you know, Kids Can was open to it. they took her name and they were looking at a bunch of different illustrators. And then ultimately they decided that she was going to be the person to do the book. And I was just so happy because.
You know, you don't do anything right, do you?
It's luck and timing mostly in this business.
That's such a great story that you were the matchmaker of your own book. That's wonderful.
Well, you know, a very big nod to Kids Can and the art director and the editor there for being open to it too, because not everybody is.
So I'm going to hit myself after I say this, but it was a case of a penny for your thoughts.
Serendipity is what we like to call it. Yeah.
So now, since you do everything differently than most people, let's go back to the young Anna. In the previous interview, you talked a lot, but maybe not enough about the 5-year-old. Do you write to your 5-year-old? You know, I always ask this question.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost, I don't know. And I don't know that I write to my own kids. It's almost just kind of like you reach back into that part of your brain where you can talk to kids. But I don't know if it's a kid specifically. I think it's just kind of you go back into that place where, because I mean, this, you know, it's lyrical writing is tricky too, because it has to be, it has to have a certain feeling. It has to evoke emotion, but it also has to make sense to kids. And, you know, some people that have not liked this book at all, like, I don't think kids can understand what's going on, but you know, kids are often smarter than we give them credit for, and they can figure things out. They know a lot of things, and especially with the illustrations, they can piece together what it is happening on the page. So yeah, I think it's just finding that part of your mind that remembers what it was like to be a kid. So maybe, yeah, maybe.
What was it like to be a 5-year-old? You grew up in Winnipeg?
I grew up in Winnipeg, and then we lived in the Soviet Union for almost 4 years for my dad's job, which was like a gigantic culture shock.
I remember you talking about the rifles and the soldiers. And
yeah, I'd never seen a gun until we arrived at our compound we were living in.
If I were your psychologist and we were talking, which I'm not, and we're talking about the reasons, the angst that you're writing towards. So would this be like the 5-year-old before Moscow, or like you were in Moscow till you were between 6 and 9 or something, and then you came back? So where is your angst, dear Anna?
I think a lot of my angst actually is when we came back and try to integrate back into a world that you're not really part of anymore. And the kids are like, you're weird. And then you lead into that. You become even weirder because they don't like you, you know?
I like you.
Well, this is little, like younger kids. This is like middle school kids, and they can be fairly mean, right? So it's kind of figuring out where you belong in the world. But I think like I was young enough when we moved overseas that everybody there was in the same position, because the school I went to was all kids of diplomats and journalists and foreign whoevers that were there, and they all spoke English, but they were from all over the world. So my experience of school was around people from everywhere that spoke every language, and that's just what it was. And I came back here and it was not that. And it was like, you know, fairly suburban white kids who had never really seen or done much, but didn't like the fact that I had seen and done things and didn't want to know about it. So I think that was probably, so I was 10. That was probably the biggest cultural shock, was coming home.
The other thing that struck me about your history, your biography, is that you studied art at college. You went into photographs and collages, and I interviewed Hanoch Piven, who's made a wildly successful international career with the photographs and collages.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked you last time, you know, why aren't you toying with your artistic visual side? Is that an Oyvind question?
I think about it. I think it may come to that at some point. That's a whole other thing, though, right? Because writing is one thing, illustrating is one thing, writing and illustrating well together is a whole other thing. And I know I spent some time working as an editor with a publisher in New York for a bit, and I know that sometimes one of those things can be great and the other one is not. So you basically have to be amazing at two things.
But agents are looking almost exclusively now for author illustrators, and you potentially are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't draw... No, I'm not. I have a certificate.
Yes.
Melvin cannot draw.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Maybe one day.
You know, like Reynolds' book, The Dots.
Yes.
I failed on page one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it would have to be the right idea that I would want to be, you know, pulled into doing that. And I'm not sure what that would be yet.
But is it possible that because you're also an artist, you have a sensitivity for leaving the space for the illustrator? Maybe that's why your writing is so sparse.
My writing wasn't sparse when I started. Like everyone else, like you start out writing like these massive, like this is a 2,000 page picture book. This is going to be amazing.
You're spoiling my theory, dear.
No, but I think there's two things to that. I think there's part of it is the art background. So you can, like, I don't try to imagine the illustrations because that's not my job. And a lot of people do, and they're upset if the color is wrong or the something. I think it's better not to think about it too much and just leave it open. So I try to do that. But yeah, like writing just enough that there's something else that's going to happen on the page. But also my day job is I work in radio, which is all storytelling with sound. So there's no images. So it's similar, but very different. So you have, how do we tell a story without images? It's all using sound. It's all using music. It's all sound design. So it's, to me, that has actually been extremely helpful in transitioning to picture books, because it's similar skills that you need to have to kind of do half a thing, right? And leave space for the sound or the art
and the rest. And also storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, storytelling big time.
So I was just thinking, like thinking about our previous conversation today. There's also another well-known writer called Julia Donaldson, mm-hmm. Who everybody knows, of course, the Gruffalo. Mm-hmm. I actually bumped into her in a coffee house in Athens and had coffee with her. That's another story.
Another show.
I'm interviewing you today. But the incredible thing about Julia is that she started out at the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly, you know, your background is the proper background for conquering the world.
Oh, good. I just need a Gruffalo idea.
Well, we'll talk after the show. We'll kick everybody out and have a little Gruffalo-Fuffalo discussion. So what I wanted to ask you is, so you found Penny,
mm-hmm.
and she did these marvelous illustrations. I would like to interview her also for the show. She appears to be one wonderful, wonderful illustrator. Mm-hmm. To give this transition, you know, from black and white to color, but it's not black and white at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not color at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have, when the book comes out, what feelings do you have in the fact that, and this is not your first book that somebody else has illustrated, it's my book, it's not my book. It's my book, it's not my book.
It's our book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. I mean, generally, and especially, you know, if you think about, as you said, how few words are in the book, the heavy lifting is done by the illustrations in this book. This book would be a poem, right? It would be very different. The experience would be not nearly as rich, not nearly as meaningful. Like Penny was able to capture the moods of things in a way that, you know, you can do with words, but when you have the art to go with it, it just elevates it to a completely different level. So I always thought it, I mean, from the second I saw those illustrations and decided, oh my God, it has to be her. Hopefully that will work. It was going to be our book. So it's, yeah, I don't, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, illustrator credits and names on the book. And, you know, our names are both on the book and there's no, if you can see it, it doesn't say written by, illustrated by, mm-hmm. It's just us.
And they're the both size font, the same sized font.
Yeah, because often the writer's name will be first and then it just illustrated by the illustrator. But there is a, now there seems to be a movement now to remove that because it's it's an equal, sometimes slightly more leaning on the illustrator kind of partnership, right? It's, they do a lot of work.
Absolutely. So you don't have any problem with that?
No. I mean, think if Penny, because who knows what the book would look like? I can't imagine. But without the illustrator, there's no book. So that's kind of an important thing.
So I should start interviewing more illustrators.
Yeah. It would be really interesting to find out because, I mean, there were a few art notes sprinkled into this, mm-hmm. not a lot. And then, but it would be really interesting to hear how an illustrator thinks about text and what they decide to put in. Or because sometimes the story changes or they put in things that you don't think about and suddenly you're like, oh, that makes it better, right? So it's really fascinating, I think, to find out what the process is for people as they're bringing someone else's words to life, but also injecting themselves into the book too.
Mm, absolutely. You've given me a lot of food for thought. Can you talk about your next book coming out, or it's a secret, or has it been announced?
It hasn't been announced. It doesn't have an illustrator yet, but it's in a similar, so it's with Kids Can as well. It's in a similar vein to Dark Cloud. This one I wrote during the pandemic. So this one is actually about loss. And it's about, my editor actually told me what it was about, which I didn't realize, which is Kathleen again at Kids Can. She's like, oh, it's about, you know, being in the moment of loss, but also moving forward and creating new memories. And I thought, oh, that's so lovely. It is. It's about creating new memories once you're kind of processing this loss. So that's the next one that's coming out. And then I have a couple more that are ready to go out. One that is out on submission now, and they're much more cheerful. So there'll be some more cheerful books coming too.
So you told me in the previous discussion, you can, of course, deny everything you told me, that you kind of, you know, you had a successful career in the radio, and then you said, no, I also want to write picture books. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you said, which I found really endearing, was that you didn't know what you were doing.
No.
I didn't know that?
There were so many rules and processes. I had no, I didn't know anything about any of it.
You just charged right in like Caitlin Aronson's bull in the china shop. Actually, her bull doesn't ruin the china shop or tries not to. And you just went in there, you know, with both feet and kicked your way in. And that's brilliant. And we talked about this last time. You know, you're one in several thousand, maybe 10,000 authors that have multiple books coming out. And you have a wonderful agent now. Do you want to mention your agent?
Yep, Jennifer Enter at the Enter Agency.
I would love to interview her too. And so, you know, this could lead to, I might get you to be like a co-host on the show. You're so wonderful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, really, you're not working anymore?
Oh, no, I'm still working.
Ah, okay. Well, when you decide not to work anymore.
I'll just come and interview you about your book.
Yeah, you can't interview me about my book.
No.
Because, no, you can, but not for the New Books Network.
Fair enough.
Because my book is in Hebrew. And what are you going to ask me? And what will I say? And, you know. Yeah, you know what? You can, but not. Well, we'll talk. We'll talk.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you, dear. So but this is about you and your beautiful book. So still, you've had this singular success. You know, you came from a background of art school and writing and radio, and then you found a really wonderful niche for yourself in picture book writing. And so, I mean, we're not going to say to people, you know, if you want to be a successful picture book writer, go to school for 4 years to fine arts. And then get a job in the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. But because you're on this successful trek, and you told me the T-Rex is doing well, which I'm really happy about, you must have all kinds of advice for authors. And in our last discussion, we ran out of time, and we didn't have time for what is Anna's advice to authors, given your quirky road to success.
Yeah, I guess I would say, like, in some ways, it's really freeing to not know all the things that I now know about the process and what you're supposed to do and not do. And I think letting go of all the writing rules, even some of the querying rules, like querying is awful. So there's that. But I think just like really.
But you told me now that you found your current agent mm-hmm. from the slush pile.
Yep.
You should be teaching how to write a successful query letter. Because, okay, yes, you could write there all about me. I'm already published. I'm already traditionally published. Mm-hmm. But you have to get the agent to read down to the third paragraph about Anna.
Yeah, and I think some agents don't read them at all. I think sometimes they take a quick look at the pages, whatever you've sent in, and if they don't like it, they don't bother because they have 700 other ones and they don't have time to really get to know you very well. So, but I just like, you know, I have a query letter that I used. The other thing that I will say is save everything. You know, I saved everything, every query letter, I have pitches for everything. So when I parted ways with my first agent in October, I wasn't starting from scratch. I could go back and pull out the query letter that got me a whole bunch of interest the first time around and then just basically use that as a template. I think people spend so much time personalizing things, and I don't think that's worth your time or effort. Like I could query 40 people in a day because it's a template, right? You don't need to, oh, they like this show, I'll put in a note about that. Like nobody has time for this. You know, they don't have time to read it. You're putting so much work in that you don't know if anybody's ever seeing it. So for me, personalizing became something that I did at the beginning. And I now don't think it's really worth, unless there's something really specific that you have with that agent, but how many people could that be true of, right? So writers are bending over backwards trying to personalize and finding perfect comps. And, you know, and I really think it's just a waste of time.
I told you that
very controversial.
I told you that I'm doing things wrong.
Mm.
So how
that's for me. I mean, that might not be true for other people. And people might love it, right? Great.
How wonderful a person are you on a scale of 0 to 10?
I don't know. I guess that depends who you ask.
I'm going to challenge you to share your query letters.
Okay.
You know, share your query letters. Send them to me. I'll share them. I mean, you have some gift.
Well, I have a master's degree in journalism, so I can write things. You know, writing query letters is different from writing books, but it's all the same skill set, right? So I've been, over the course of my, you know, 20 plus years in radio, I've been able to distill writing down into very small bits as needed and just keeping the most important things. I was lucky when I first started querying, I won a thing on Twitter where I had someone go over my query letter and she made some great points and that became the template I used for everything. So I think the nice thing about, you know, Kidlit and being part of that community, maybe not as much on Twitter now as it was before, but like people are so willing to help and offer advice and just, you know, look over things for, like, it's amazing what you can, this group of people that don't necessarily have to support each other, but they do. And it's this wonderful, warm kind of place.
It is. Mm-hmm. From these interviews, like I want to just, you know, run over to Winnipeg and give you a great big hug, because the writers I meet are such wonderful, lovely people. Actually, I met a few of them in New York and Tel Aviv recently, and they're even lovelier than they are on camera, and so willing to help and to share and to give free advice. Most of them, some people make a living. We're not going to talk about that. But it's important to tell people the chance of getting published, it doesn't matter in Israel, in Canada, or whatever, is less than 1 in 1,000. And whatever ways you can do to increase that, you know, that very rare occasion, is, I think, that you have to embrace.
You know, you what feels right for you. Like some people like to query 5 people and then stop and wait. And my brain doesn't work that way. Like I just have to, I treat it like a job. It's like, okay, this is what I'm doing today. I'm doing this, 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 this. And if things come back, more things go out. The day I split with my last agent, I sent a query letter out. I'm not a waiting around to see what happens kind of person. I'm like,
How much do you charge? I'm we're gonna have to do some barter or something. I'm just gonna have to pay you money to be my my querying mentor. Every time I have to query, I want to throw up. And then I do all this research, and then they say, oh, you know, you like mosquitoes, and I have a story on I lived in, I grew up in Winnipeg, so I'm sending you this. I know that you'll love it. You're flying in the face of commonness. And I applaud you for that, because
I think there are more people that do this. I think maybe it's just not talked about as much. But again, like it's your own comfort zone. I think if you're going to do this, this is where art school was good, because art school, you put up work, everyone tears it to bits. So I started this when I was like 17 years old. I was in art school. So you start with critiques, and everything you do for 4 years, people say, oh, this is good, but this is everything that's terrible. So by the time you get through that, like you have to have a certain level of self-confidence to keep putting it out, and a certain level of, I don't really care what you think if I like it. And there may be points that you have that make sense that I can work on, but I'm, you know, some people get completely destroyed by critiques or by a rejection or, you know, and it's hard. Like even the last time I was querying, I got some amazing passes from agents. It's just like, am I ever going to find another agent? Like, I don't know, because that's how hard it is now. It's so much harder than it was a few years ago. And hats off to everybody still doing it, because it's brutal. But I think you have to keep that level of self-confidence up, because it will completely destroy you if you're not ready for that. And I think so many people are like, oh, I wrote a nice story, and now I'm going to let critique partners read it, and they don't like it. And then they completely like don't know what to do, because it's hard, because it's you, right? So it always feels like they're criticizing you, but it's not. It's like separate from you. And you have to be open to what makes sense to you criticism wise and just be like, okay, but that's what you think, but clearly that's not what I want for this. So we'll just park that over here. And I think it's valuable to hear those kind of opinions. Like I had one person that hated this book in draft form, and she was like, I don't relate to this at all. I don't think this works. I was like, then this isn't going to be a book that you're going to buy. And that's fine, because other people will. Like, not everyone has to like your book. That's the other thing, right? Not everybody will. That's why we have millions of kinds of books, because if we all like the same books, there'd be 10 books.
I teach at university. Mm-hmm. I have 100 students in my class, and they're all happy campers, and one is playing with their smartphone or something. That one drives me crazy. You know, 90 people will say, I like Mel's course, and one will say, it's a lousy course.
Yeah.
So what is it about me? What do I need to do to become Anna and to say to that person, go screw yourself?
Well, not that, but that's like they're not.
Why do we always go to the people who are the naysayers, the detractors? Mm-hmm. How do we overcome that? Are you also a psychologist?
That's human nature. No, I really think it's just, you got to pile it up. Like you need so much of it that you kind of get used to it. You can't expect everybody to like everything, because it's not going to happen. So I think in that sense, you teach to the other 90%, because they're the ones that are getting back from you, right? So not everyone's going to like it. Not everyone has to like it. But I think you have to get to that place in your mind that I'm going to not serve the other 90% if I'm focused on the 10. And then nobody's getting what they want out of it, right? And it's not fun for you. So I think as long as it's not, like, we do this for almost no money, right? Often with no chance of publication.
We do it with money, Anna, but it's our money.
Yes, our money. But I mean, there's often people will do this for years, and there's no guarantee that anything's going to happen. Like, you may never get another agent, you may never sell a book, but we keep going because we want to do it.
It's the contrary. Mm-hmm. You know, if the odds are 999 to 1,000, you know, in your not favor.
Yeah.
You know, we are sort of, maybe you and I aren't anymore, but we're still a little bit Michigan-y, because, you know, like, even if you get paid, it still comes out to 10 cents an hour or whatever. But I look at writing as a calling. Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't know about you, but I don't have that much control over it anymore. If you give me some time, I'm just going to sit down and write. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, oh, thank God I can sit down and write. And it's like, nobody's paying me for this. I'm now turning down jobs so that I can sit and lose money writing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Let's open your wonderful book and read us a little bit of
it. So we can't read much, right? We can read a little bit.
I didn't ask you to read much. It's less than 300 words. We don't want to get everybody upset.
No. So let's read a couple of pages. So the first page, Abigail had a dark cloud. One day it just appeared. She shut the door, but it followed her in. The rain made everything damp. So then it kind of goes along. She's experiencing things that are not so happy. And then here's something about the middle of the book. Abigail had tangled thoughts, but couldn't lift the comb. Her dad sat quietly on the bed and gave her a polka dot bow. So here is Penny's imaginings of Abigail with her tangled thoughts. And then you see the little yellow bow.
That's so poignant. There's another one where she's walking hand in hand with Daddy.
That's my favorite. Yeah,
she senses that he feels, yeah.
This is my favorite text in the book. Yeah, by far. So Abigail had a dark cloud. It felt a bit familiar. Her dad held her hand, and then she knew sometimes he had cloudy days too. And you don't see him. You just see, you know, this little girl looking up at her dad with her beautiful colored backpack. Yeah, that's my favorite text, I think, in the book, because that's the turning point for her, because then she kind of takes it on. She's like, okay, I can figure this out. And she does. Yeah, because the other thing that came up with this book was that there weren't, like, her parents weren't really, they don't talk to her, right? So they're there. It was like, well, we have to make sure the parents are there so she doesn't feel like she's alone. So that was kind of on Penny to figure out how to incorporate the parents in, like, her birthday party scene. So she's dealing with it a lot on her own, but also she has support all around her. So you don't feel like, oh my God, this poor kid's just kind of out in the wilderness alone. So she had to be rooted with people who cared for her. So you see them in the story a lot more than you hear it in the text.
It's a lovely story. It's a bit like my story. It's a good thing that I only saw it today. Otherwise, you know, I might have said... Abigail and Emily. So this has been a wonderful conversation. And we're going to have to find a way so that we don't have to meet every 2 years. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
Okay.
I always enjoy talking to you. It's always fun.
And likewise. And we're going to get rid of everybody and continue. But if you share one or two query letters, maybe you do know what angst this is for people who are looking for agents in North America. Mm-hmm. Literally and literarily, a needle in a haystack. And I think that you can help. And I want to apologize because I forgot your master's degree in journalism.
That's okay.
And I've had at least one other wonderful author on the show who studied journalism and then marketing and advertising. And maybe us authors need a crash course in journalism.
The marketing helps too. Writing pitches is so hard for people, especially about their own work. Often it's easier to write pitches for other people because you're not invested, right? So I would write pitches for people as contests, like people who were struggling with pitches for their own book, because then you read it and write the pitch and they're like, oh, that's what it is, right? Same thing as when my editor said, oh, this is what your book's actually about. And I was like, yes, it is. Because sometimes you can't see it. You're too deeply in it and it's hard to tell. So you need someone else to come in and pull out the marketing hook and then you're good to go.
So what, you help people with PB pitches and stuff?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
What a sweetheart you are, like voluntarily.
Yeah.
You see,
it's that helping nature of the kidlit world. People wouldn't believe what it's actually like.
No, it's very helpful. But I think that part of the reason is that we're not really competing. You know, if there's like a thousand people competing for one position or for one book or for one agent, you're not really competing. I mean, you can be, you know, if the writer who got the deal, mm-hmm, is writer number 437 and you're writer 289, you can still feel a ton of empathy. You're not like, it's not like the guy next to you. And mm-hmm, if you know this person, you can really be rooting for them. Like, I read your book hoping I would love it, and I loved it. So Anna, this has been terrific. You have two beautiful books that we've talked about. T-Rexes Can't Tie Their Shoes, which I feel strong empathy towards. And your new one, Dark Cloud, Show It Again, from Kids Can Press, which is just out, with the remarkable illustrator Penny Neville Lee from Manchester. Mm-hmm. And a very a very brave book. And like you, nothing is done in the standard way here. It's very brave, unique, challenging, not happy-go-lucky, and I love it.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
I was so happy to see you, I forgot to introduce the program. So I'm going to introduce the program.
Go for it.
Hi, hi everybody. I'm Mel Rosenberg. I'm the host of the Children's Literature Channel for the New Books Network. And I have a wonderful guest today, Anna Lazowski, and we're celebrating her new book, Dark Cloud. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you
for being on the show. So we're going to go back. We're going to go out, kick everybody out, and go back in. Whether or not you have people in your family who have issues of feeling down, it's still a wonderful book for everybody. I think it has a universal message.
I hope so. Thank you.